Australian Futsal Committee, welcome to your Australia Futsal in Australia podcast. This is edition number 7. Every edition we bring a special guest to the show, and today is no different. But before we get to our guest, let's first welcome my co-host for today, Fernando de Moraes. Welcome. Thank you for being my co-host for today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Andre. It's great to be part of it once again, and now as a co-host. It's great, amazing to be here, you know, being part of an interviewing Mr. Rob.
Okay, so let's get to the guest, Rob Varela. When we think about legends in Australia, there is probably no biggest legend than this one. Rob, thank you so much for accepting to come on the show, and we look forward to talking to you.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, I think there's so many people looking forward to hear from your experience. And let's get right into it. Rob, before we talk about the coach, Rob, and the player, Rob, who is Rob off of the court? Where were you born? Where you grew up?
I was born in Uruguay, by the way, which is where futsal started, and migrated to Australia as a schoolboy. I did play a little bit of futsal in Uruguay, but mainly what they call baby football, which is 7-a-side outdoor. Okay, that's what we play until you're about 12, 13, and then you decide to whether you want to go onto football or not. I love the sport. I was lucky enough to play football at a decent level here in Australia. I play for Melita Eagles in Sydney, as well as in Adelaide United in Adelaide. Due to injury, pretty bad groin injury, I sort of gave it up, mid to late 20s, and I thought I would like to take up coaching. So I started taking coaching courses for football, and then in the mid-80s, we moved from Adelaide back to Sydney, and I got a job coaching the old Sydney City Hakawa under 12s outdoor, and then moved on to Melita, 12 boys. And at the end of the first season with Melita, we decided to keep fitness and keep active, to play this funny game of indoor soccer, as it was called, with a little heavy ball. So we had 16 boys. We broke them up into 2 teams of 8. I knew nothing about the sport in terms of the rules and the tactics and things like that. And we just basically play for fun and defend and try and score when we had it. And I never looked back. I've gone back to coaching football once or twice, you know, for a few months here or there. But once the futsal bug beat me, you know, I was, you know, committed to it. And that's what I wanted to do.
You got through very quickly. So we're going to have to take a couple of steps back just quickly.
Sure.
Rob, futsal in Uruguay, did you get to see any futsal back then? Or I know you said that was just baby soccer, but...
Yeah. You played. Most social clubs would have a futsal court in at the back, you know, with tiles and things. And you see a lot of those in Argentina and Brazil as well. Obviously, mm-hmm. It is not as big as what it is in Brazil, where you see a futsal court in anywhere you go. So I did play a little bit, but mainly, like I said, that 7-a-side baby football. So I enjoyed the fact that I didn't have to run a lot. I never liked running. So playing on small spaces was fun. Yeah, exactly. To be honest, Fernando, I mean, I never set foot on a proper football field until I came to Australia. And yeah. We had trials for my high school team. I'm going, what am I doing here? This thing is so big.
What position did you play, Rob, as a
sweeper,
player?
Sweeper. Or yeah. Centre mid, not to run.
Yeah.
Elegant ball player. Now, yeah. I had the ability of being able to read the game. Okay. I wasn't a great technical player in terms of what South American players are, you know, great dribblers and that sort of, but I was a good passer of the ball. I could read the game. And one of the best compliments someone ever gave me was, you don't run, but you seem to be with the bullies, you know? So having that ability to read the game and having to rely on understanding the game rather than physical ability or technical ability, I think that helped me in the end, not only to decide that I wanted to coach, but at the same time, I needed to study the game to be able to be a good coach. Why I became a coach once I finished playing is because until I ended up at Melita at the age of 17, I had never had a proper coach. It was always well-meaning people who handed the shirts out, peeled the oranges at halftime, gave you the drink at the end of the game. They taught you a few things here or there, but so I will never know whether I would be a would have been a better player if I'd been coached properly or not. Okay. Mm-hmm. So my aim as a coach is to give players the ability to be the best they can be, whatever their talent can give them, make the best of whatever they have. Yeah.
Do you think back in the days, obviously, because the sport wasn't so big, is that one of the reasons that you couldn't develop many players, or many players actually gave up on being, you know, pursuing their futsal career or something like that?
In Australia was the old indoor soccer thing. Okay, that was hidden away somewhere. I think even though the National League and the state leagues and all that were of very good standard, it was still the perception that it is something that you do if you cannot make it in football. Uh-huh. Or it is fun to play with your mates once a week, half an hour, but is there a career for it? Okay. Mm-hmm. I've been in Australia for a long time until I found out by accident what this indoor soccer thing was. I had no idea. When I started coaching indoor soccer, it was under 12s. The boys were turning 13. There was just the one under 12 competition in Sydney at Risby, which is where they used to play the old National League games as well, Futsal National League, Futsal Indoor Soccer League. So I found out by accident that, you know, there was an indoor soccer league. People were playing at a decent level. A funny anecdote, if I may take up 30 seconds. When we won that league, this short little guy, very muscular, very fit-looking gentleman, you know, 50s, 55, comes up to me and says, I want to talk to your player. I said, mate, this is grand final. Just go away. Well, I need to talk to your player because I used to lift weights for Australia. Mate, just go away. Not so nicely. So he went away. And my team played another team and we won the grand final. And then they do the presentation in the foyer, and this little short guy is standing there in his suit and tie. And the guy running the competition says, I'd like to introduce to you Mr. Joe Brent, president of the Indoor Soccer Association. I just told the guy where to go half an hour before. And the host says, Mr. Brent, I'd like to introduce to you the coach of the winning team. And Joe goes, we've met. So it wasn't a very auspicious start to my indoor soccer career. Well, I had no idea who this gentleman was. You know, we got to know each other, a period of time. But Stephen Knight was one of the big stars at the time. He could have walked past me, you know, no idea. And then...
Hey, Rob, sorry to cut you. You played for the Melbourne Buffaloes back in the National League.
No, I didn't play.
You didn't play?
No, we moved down... for work. My wife and I moved down to Melbourne for work, and I actually got in touch with Michael Contos, who was running the Indoor Soccer Association at the time. I did a little bit of referee at a Nationals, so I think that gives me the right to give referees feedback, because I know what pressure they're under. See, that's what some of them don't understand, that coaches are under pressure, refs are under pressure. But be that as it may, I got involved in coaching. I became the coaching director for Victoria for a few years until we moved back to Sydney in 1994, coaching state teams and helping Michael with the Buffaloes. At the time, to preempt a question that you may have for later on, there was a full-on National League, home and away across the country. How was the National League back then? Correct. Televised on SBS with Johnny Warren as the presenter, Andy Pascalidis as the game caller. It was an hour on prime time on a Saturday night. About half an hour was basically highlights of the main game. And then the second half hour would be a couple of interviews with players from the main game, but then highlights of all the goals and, you know, best action of all the games, women and men. And, and to see the sport going backwards from that stage, okay, knowing that the quality of the sport now is, because of the changes to the rule, is much more watchable, much more enjoyable to watch, okay? To see that that's not happening, not only not on television, but not even being played, a National League, it is sad to see. And it makes it very hard to keep players in the sport or to attract more players to the sport when they don't see, you know, a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. But back then, it was on every Saturday night. Fantastic. And like I said, to me was an eye opener to see that there was a national league, there was a state association, there were state teams, there were nationals. You know, big. I mean, just to fill in for people who are sort of newer to the sport, back in those days, I'm not saying they were better or worse, but back in those days, the nationals were running Canberra all the time over the Australia Day long weekend. You would play, the state teams would play on Saturday, on Friday. It'd be home on, round robins. Saturday morning up to lunch, it would be semi-finals or grand finals. And on Saturday afternoon, Sunday and Monday, there will be club championships. The men's division would be 13, 14 groups or four or five teams. So there'd be 60 men's teams competing, playing against each other. But in Canberra at the Institute, it was massive. And to see now that we may be going to the Nationals in Queensland, which is good because we haven't had it for 2 years, but that be lucky to get four or five states, you know, in an age group. Like I said, it is sad to see. I mean, it is what it is, but for those of us who have been around in the sport for over 30 years, to know what heights the game, you know, got up to back then in a very amateur way. There was hardly no money, very amateur way. Players paid to play, junior players. But to see the participation, the numbers, and it was a very definite football and futsal season. Now the football season keeps getting bigger and bigger. It basically squashes the futsal season even more and more. And that makes it very, very hard. And coupled with the fact that most kids are 13, 14, 15, and the parents think the letter from Man United is in the mail coming, and they're going to be making $1 million a week in no time, makes it very hard to attract them to futsal and make futsal appear as a very viable sport. Because some players, to be honest, 0.1% play A-League. You know, you can represent your country. You know, I mean, you played at a very good level, Fernando, but you represented your country in football, in futsal. Other kids will be able to represent at a World Cup or Asian level or whatever, even just against New Zealand. Very few people can say, I play for my country. You can do that in futsal. It's a lot easier, more accessible than football. But
exactly,
you don't want to steal the dreams and tell them, don't play football. But at the same time, what I advise players is just weigh your priorities. You know, what are your chances of, number one,
making A-League? The national team? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If you're not playing first grade at the age of 16, 17, you're not going to play A-League. If you're not playing NPL 1 at the age of 16, 17, you're not good enough to be playing A-League. And then if you're not playing A-League, you're not going to play for Australia. Well, you can still have a good, enjoyable football career combined with a good, enjoyable, even representative futsal career.
I think you find a lot of clubs out there and a lot of coaches and a lot of people around clubs and stuff. They're trying to get these kids involved. They're trying to get, it's more like a business now than to say, to go into the parent and say, your kid's not going to make it.
Yeah.
You want to stay here, you can stay here. We got seniors, you can play, whatever, but your kid's not good enough. There's no one that's going to come to your kid unless he go and make and get a trial at a professional team. They're going to say, you're not good enough, see you later, and that's it. But in those clubs, NPL or whatever, NPL 2, 3, whatever it is, most of the clubs, they won't tell the kid they're not good enough because obviously it comes back to money and business. So, and then the kid is stuck there. And then the parents think, oh, my kid's good enough. And then he's bouncing from club to club and he's wasting or losing the opportunity of being a bigger and better player in futsal and representing the country, you know, with big chances. So I think it's very hard. It's very hard.
I mean, I've got a very clear example, Fernando. 2 weeks ago, I'm coaching the women's team and the 17 girls. A girl, she's 16, good player, good futsal player. I get a phone call saying, we can't train Tuesday night because I'm playing with a football club. This is October we're talking about. 16-year-old kid, they train Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday night, Saturday morning. She's been told she's a key player. I said, well, does she look like breaking into the WWE league team? Oh no. You know?
So yeah, it's hard. It's really hard.
Yeah. Rob, it was important. We have no doubt it was important to have a national league that the players could inspire to play. And so that probably attracted lots of players. But how was the national team back then as well in the 80s and the 90s?
I'm talking, looking in from the outside. We held the World Cup in Australia in 1988. We did quite well. To be honestly, 100% honest, the standard of some of the teams was very poor. Okay. For example, and I'm not talking out of school here, the Hungarian team were basically, if anyone was younger than 40, please. The Italian team wasn't anything like, you know what I mean? But the Brazilian team was unbelievable. Paraguayan team was fantastic. The Spanish team was very good. The Portuguese team was not really, really good. But then the standard fell away. The Australian guys did very well, once again, as being basically amateurs or semi-professionals working and playing futsal. And in hindsight, I might disagree with some of the selections that took place at the time, but it was a good team, you know. Stephen, you know, we all know Stephen Knight. He was part of that team, one of the better players there. There were some really good players, and they did very well. They won the games that they were supposed to win, and they pushed Brazil very hard. I think it was a 5-0 loss, but the goalkeeper, Thurlow, I forget his first name, he had a best goalkeeping game I've seen anybody ever. You know, he was fantastic. And to be able to watch it, see, I found out that the World Cup was on by accident. I won tickets to go and watch a game on a radio. You know, if you're in this number now, your price would be 2 tickets to go and watch the Indoor Soccer World Cup and go, what the hell? I didn't even know it was on. So I went with my wife, watched that game. Then we went back the next day and the next at the old glass house. I remember one of the things that I remember is I walking into the place and I see this massively tall guy, you know, my head reached his kneecaps. It was Andrew Gaze, you know, the basketball player. But I said to my wife, okay, the game kicks off at 7. It's a World Cup. You know, there's a game at 7 o'clock and a game at 9 o'clock. I think we need to be there about 6 to make sure we get good seats. The doors weren't open. You couldn't get into
the crowd. What was the crowd back then?
Oh, about 150?
It was,
150 people?
Yeah.
And they only used one stand, you know, and most of the tickets were giveaways, okay, which was sad. I mean, no one knew. The Australian team deserved to have more support. Whether they were good, bad, or indifferent is irrelevant. You're the home team and you're playing, you know, you deserve to have a good crowd behind you.
Yeah.
You know? But like I said, it was one of the best kept secrets ever. We were hosting a World Cup. It started off in Canberra, and then the finals, you know, the main games in the finals moved to Melbourne. You know, even the grand final, Brazil against Paraguay. Like if we had 1,000 people. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine a World Cup now?
Brazil and Paraguay in Australia.
Or whoever, you know.
I think the social media would help a lot, you know.
Oh, wasn't any back then, obviously. Yeah. But I mean, I think it was basically the wives and the girlfriends of the Australian players, and if they had kids, a couple of kids, and people who won free tickets like me.
Yeah. So,
like I said, the bigger thing is let's go in early because we might not be, because when number tickets, it's just general admission. I thought, oh, we're going to get a good seat, mate. You could have taken 4 seats if you wanted to.
Yeah.
So that's sad. And that's always been the case with futsal. It's the poor relation. You know, once people are exposed to it, whether they're playing or watching, they'll go, wait, where was this game before? So, type of thing. But our job is to get people exposed to the game, get them playing and watching, you know?
I think most of the people that get exposed to the game early, they fall in love with the game because it's so much action, so many things you can do in such a small time.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's amazing, you know, just to sit and watch. Yeah. It's unbelievable.
I mean, it's a perfect game for television. I'm sure
exactly.
KO and Stan and all those channels, we got lots of one hour time slots to fill.
And some of the sports that they show out there, it's crazy as well.
Even for the purists, the game might not be a great futsal game, but it could still be 6-5.
Yeah.
You may be what, and the problem is trying to attract non-football people to football. They look at you like Aussie rules, you know, 110 to 95. You know, rugby league, 35 to 29. Soccer, as they call it, nil all. What am I going to go and sit there for 90 minutes to watch nothing? Futsal might not be an unreal game in terms of, you know, the tactics and the techniques, but it could be 6-5, 10-9, 8-6, 4-5. You don't see any low draw. So people will be
a lot of action, yeah. A lot of action all the time.
And if your kid is playing and he happens to score a goal, I mean, if I was a parent of a football kid and he sits on the left wing for 10 minutes before the ball comes anywhere near him, I'm going, what am I paying $1,000 a year for here? My kid doesn't get a kick. You know?
And we go to play futsal and he touched the ball every second of the game. Exactly. He's attacking, he's defending, he's involving all the time. He's just
having
fun. He can be a goalie, having fun, you know. Yeah.
And if you're playing in your local comp, your game is at 4 o'clock. It's done by 4:30. You can go and do whatever you do. I know that if your coach, if your kid is an 8-9 year old and he plays soccer, football, his game is at 8 o'clock in the morning. In winter, it's raining, it's muddy. You know, cow poo on the pitch, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, a lot of fact.
And Rob, but,
like I said, we're pricing the game to once again to ourselves rather than people from outside that need to know about it. Yeah.
So Rob, when we think of Rob, we think of Jura Warriors. Since I moved to Australia 11 years ago, I always think of Rob, Jura Warriors. When did your time start at Jura Warriors? Were you there since the foundation of the club?
No, the center is owned by the Baptist Church. They decided rather than build a bigger church, let's build a sports center where people can come and play sport.
What an amazing idea.
Just to link up with the thing. And started way before my time. So a friend of mine said, look, there's an indoor soccer place that wants a coach to run a couple of days clinics during the school holidays. Are you available? Yeah, I'll go over. That was back in 1997. And then they probably like what I did or didn't do. And they said, oh, we're doing it again next school holidays. Then we're doing it again next school holidays. And then it
Drew was founded in 94. So you joined Drew about 3 years after?
97.
Drew was founded in 94 before? 3 years before you joined?
So. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that's when the center started. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the guy said, would you like to come and work for me? I'm thinking, I've been doing this for nothing all my life. So getting paid to do something you love, no brainer. So I started coaching there, and the dual players, the dual teams in those state leagues at the time, they were known as the kids from the hills. They were nice kids, but couldn't play. And it was true. They were nice kids that couldn't play. My job was to make him competitive. Okay. So yeah, we got involved and haven't looked back. Yeah. It's been a big part of my life.
Rob. What's the best memory you have from Juro? Just thinking of about anything. It could be a game. It could be something that happened. A kid that made it up all the way to the top, or anything.
There's a few. Obviously, winning 10 grand finals with the men's out of 11 years is a bit of a highlight. But it's a testimony not just to the men's teams or my coaching, but the system that develop players.
Can you please explain just a little bit more? Because I know that's the Premier League in Sydney. Yeah. That's been running. That's a great competition, and it's been around forever.
Yeah.
Obviously, you guys had some great teams there and the great players. Mm-hmm. Very hard competition, obviously. So you won 10 out of 11.
Yeah, we made our first grand final and we lost to Sydney City. Then we won the next five. Then we lost one. Then we won the next five. Okay. But what it is more a testimony to what our club is about. We believe that junior teams, what you do with junior team is to teach them how to play the game. And the aim is for them to become men's players. Your Gregs, your Tobys, Niskis, Wade. They all started at Jura when they were 10, 11, 12. 10 years later than in the men's team. Okay. If those junior teams happen to pick up a championship here or there, fantastic. If you look at the best football teams around the world, your Barcelonas and all that, what is the academy for? Yes, they win things, but they want to basically
develop the
produce players for the first team.
For the first
team. As a whole. So us winning 10 out of 11, I think it's a testimony to what we do as a club in terms of whether you agree with the way we want to play the game or not, it's irrelevant. That the fact that we are teaching 10, 11-year-olds to play like men. And it is hard for them because it's hard to execute as a 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old. But as they get older, and people say to me, oh, you're lucky because you pick a 15, 16-year-old guy or a girl, and you put in your men and women's team, and they seem to do well. Well, because they know what to do. Yes, they're still young, but they know what to do. There are eight others in the same under-16s team that they know what to do, but they're not good enough to do it at men's level. Not every 16-year-old goes into the men's team. But they've been given the tools to play like men. So that's one of the highlights. Another highlight is the fact that in 2002, we went to the Solomons in a mission trip to introduce futsal. They just come out of a civil war. In other words, shooting each other. And through Brian Codrington, who was the center manager at the time, he had connections in the Solomons. He was asked, what can you guys do to help us to bring, you know, the country together, the kids together? So we took futsal. And we all know where the Solomons are at the moment. Fantastic natural ability. They just needed to be taught the game. On the first year, we find a group of 11, 12-year-olds, that we thought, this is going to be the team that qualifies to the World Cup in 2008. That was the goal. In 2004, I coached the men in the qualifiers in Canberra. We won two games. We lost four. Some of the guys had never played futsal in their lives. But we were just marking time, bringing, you know, kids like Elliot Ragamo and James, who've been to four World Cups, and Jack and all that. So in 2008, I was the technical director slash coach. We took the team to Fiji for the qualifiers, OFC qualifiers, and we qualified for the 2008. Okay. For me personally, bittersweet experience. So happy that the kids made it. But the powers that be decided that we're too defensive. Mind you, we scored about 1,000 goals, but they wanted more attack. So somebody else took the team to the World Cup, be that as they may. So that's another highlight. With the men playing in the club championship in Asia, that's a highlight. But a really, really big one for me is taking a women's team that won the F League to Asia to play in the AFF club championship against teams that disguised as club sides were national teams. And the coaches said it. Oh, this is good practice for a national team. This is good practice for a national team. We had two 15-year-old girls, a 16-year-old girl. I think we had two girls over 25 and most of the others 21 and under. And we lost the grand final to the Vietnamese team, 3-2.
What year was that, Rob? What year was that?
2015.
I remember
2015. That. So that tells me, that tells Australia that if a club side with basically half the team being teenagers, training one night a week for an hour and a half, can go and compete with some of the best national teams in Asia, I'm 100% sure our women, given a half-decent program, even the program the Futsal Roos used to have, will be top two in Asia, no problems.
Which it wasn't no half a decent.
So, yeah, you know what I mean? And it is a crying shame that there's nothing for them. Absolutely. I got asked one day, what would you have? Would you push for a youth men's team or a women's team? I said, hey, I can play a 17-year-old in the men's team, but I can't play a woman in the men's team. So we got to have, to me, the women's team has got to come in before the youth team. I mean, to the last AFF, I took a 16-year-old in the men's team. But if she was a lady, I couldn't take her. But we need a women. We need a women. I mean, and the irony is, the Matilda this, the Matilda that, blah, 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 no, we have women's sport. Blah, blah, and we got a sport here that's got no women's representative team whatsoever. So it is sad. But answer your question, they're my main highlights. You know, the success of the men and you know, those individual things. And people ask me also, oh, what do you think your legacy is? We, most of it, well, all of our teams, junior teams, are coached by senior players. I close my eyes and I listen to them. Yes, they've got their own personality. They've got their own way of saying things. But the message that they're giving the players is the same. 12 or 10, 11, 12, 40, whatever. So that's what is satisfying for me, that we, the system that we got in place, the way we want to coach the kids, what we're going to teach them, will go on, hopefully, well after I'm under, you know, underground. Yeah.
Hey Rob, I saw an article for Greg Giovannetti in 2019. I think it was his last game in the Premier League, something like that. He thanked you for helping him. He started Drew when he was, I think, 12 until he was 30-something years old.
Yep.
But what's this system that you have put in place at Drew? Can you – I don't want you to say every – just say whatever you can say. But what's this system that you have that you managed to get so many good players?
Like I said, with all due respect, I mean, there are two ways
to make good
two
players,
main ways of playing the game, the Brazilian way and the Spanish way.
Yep.
That's there's no doubt about it. Is one better than the other? Not necessarily. Is one more appropriate than the other to certain countries? Absolutely. For example, say the Solomon Island kids, they're the closest thing I can see to Brazilian players. They can do whatever they want with the ball. But they don't like a lot of structure. They don't like a lot of discipline. So they will resent the Spanish way of playing. For Australian kids, when they're not so technically good and they only train once or twice a week, the Spanish system of teaching them good, solid skills that can be performed at speed and under pressure is more appropriate to me than, say, the Brazilian system. That doesn't make it better than the other, but it's more appropriate. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of layers to my answer. A lot of people think of futsal and they think of game of skill. And when they think game of skill, they think dribbling, nutmegs, rainbows. Far from the truth. That's the icing on the cake, whether you're Brazilian or Spanish. It's a game. If you don't have the ball, if you can't keep the ball under pressure in futsal, you're dead. So I was lucky enough to, because I speak Spanish, obviously, to get a lot of information from Spanish coaches. I became good friends with them. They became my mentors. They've invited me to go overseas and spend a month over there. And that was 2010. You know when we won the first men's competition? 2010, that season. And all of a sudden, we started playing a game that was foreign to everybody else. Oh, that's they call it the dual BS. Mm-hmm. People say, what do you teach first, attack or defense? If you don't attack, you don't score goals. That's not necessarily true. Statistically, 50% of your goals come from transition. You win the ball, you attack 3-on-2, 2-on-1, 2-on-no-1. But before you can transition in from defense to attack, you need to do what? You need to defend. We won yesterday in a women's game 4-1. Four goals. We touched the ball twice. We pressed, they lost the top of the D, we scored. So we teach them what the Spanish call individual tactics. Regardless of what system you use, 2-2, 1-0, 4-5, 21-22, if you're watching a video of a futsal game and you press stop, what is it that you see 99% of the time? What situation? 1v1. You have the ball, Andre. Fernando, you're trying to stop him. Yes, you got other players doing other things. Yeah. Keep watching it. You press the button. I have the ball. You're trying to stop me. Kids don't know. So kids need to know what my job is as the first defender, what my job is as the second defender covering, what my job is as the third defender coming from the far side, what my job is as the guy marking their attacker, top of the D. And that role changes as the ball moves. I'm the first defender against you, but then you pass it to Fernando and the guy that was the second defender becomes number one. And I need to know what my role is at any given time. And that's what we try to teach the kids in defense. Mm-hmm. They're constantly having to make decisions. So cognitively, that is half of them. 50% of the time they'll make the right decision and do the right thing. The other 50%, they'll make the wrong decision or the movement will be too late and the cop will go. But as they get older and they learn it, that's when they come into the men's team at 16, 17, 15, or two 15-year-old girls, and they know, because they've been playing the same way the senior teams play. That's what we do. In attack, and you would have heard this from Steve as well, you know, a formation is just a starting point. 3-1, 2-2, 4-0. You play the ball and you make a run and you move. That's your formation gone. It's all about supporting the ball player. Right, left, center. If you guys have a chance, there's a wonderful football DVD about Barcelona with the system, but is win the ball, pass the ball, I think it's called, or take the ball, pass the ball. And they introduce an old gentleman older than me. He's the one who invented the rondos. And he says, all we're trying to, the best formation for rondos is 4v2. So the guy on the ball can pass it to the right, to the left, or an option through the middle. And you watch, in the days of Guardiola, you watch Barcelona play. They cut the football field in four. They play futsal on four courts. Support right, support left, support center. If we teach that, and that is exactly what the Spanish system is about. I was lucky enough to spend a month there, and I learned a lot about that. And I was talking to one of the big coaches there, and I said, when did the kids learn this? We're getting when they're about 6 or 7. And here, AFF says, it's all about participation and having fun till you're about 12. So we're giving every other country in the world a 6-year head start. And then we teach them all that, the individual tactics, what the individual job is, depending on where the ball is. Obviously, that is where you need to be. And then we teach them the elite stuff. I said to the guy, when do you start teaching elite? Oh, it depends on how quickly they learn. I said, but roughly what age? He goes, 11, 12. But by that time, the kids have that thing ingrained. Fernando, you know, you yourself, Andre, you know who Pulpes is. So he's running one of the workshops, and I'm sitting there surrounded by 12-year-olds, and Pulpes puts on a little session. It's do this, does that. And I say, I knew what the answer was going to be, but I say to the young kid, why are you doing this? And the kid goes, because that's what you do. Oh, okay. They do something else. Why is he doing that? And another kid goes, because that's what you do. Okay. I went again for the third time. Why are you doing that? Whatever that was. And he goes, you call yourself a coach? That's how you play the game. That's what you do. So by the age of 10, 11, that's all in there. And then their natural ability takes over and basically, you know, dictates how far they go in the sport. That's what they do. Before the level one coaching course, they got a course for what they call monitors, which is the guys that teach those things. And that's all they teach. It is so hard to pass that course. It's not funny. Because they want the best teaching people to teach the kids, because they know if the kids don't learn that, everything else is like building a house of cards.
Fundamentals.
Yes, sir. And that's the approach that we take. We solid basis, lose or draw or win when you're who remembers who won Premier League 2016 in the under 12s? No one. Who won Premier League in the men's in 2016? Hello? You know what I mean? And gives the kids...
That's the pinnacle.
To progress. Because that's the way the game gets played overseas. It's not about all dribbling and running around like idiots. It's not a robot playing chess totally. It's a combination of both. But if you don't know what the basics of the sport is, you may be successful at Australian level, but you're not going past that. So to answer your question in a long way, that's what we teach our kids.
Boys, very good, very good. We're having lots of ground to cover, so we're going to have to move on a little bit quicker now. Sure. Just quickly, moving to the national team, all right? So national team in 2009, you were appointed by Steve and I to be his assistant coach.
Yep.
Australia was the first time that Australia qualified for the World Cup playing through the AFC, playing the AFC. What was something that you guys worked on to make Australia qualify, because they didn't qualify in 2008?
Our goal, obviously, is to qualify in terms of results, but our philosophy was let's make a team bloody hard to be beaten. Make it, when the draw comes out, we wanted people to say, oh, no, we're playing Australia. Oh, we can beat them, but God's going to be hard. So we worked on being hard to beat, on knowing that we are not going to have the ball a lot. So we had to defend very well. First defender, second defender covering, then you cover your mate. If you get beaten, you cover your mate, then you keep covering your mate, and then you counterattack a few set pieces. And when we have it, let's not give it away cheaply. That was our philosophy. That's where we started from. And the biggest problem in Australia in terms of the game improving, the standard of play, is not, and for the futsal rules, it's not that we get together once every whatever. It's the fact that when a lot of players come into the national team setup, we need to coach them as club players, because that coaching, that basis is not there. We picked them on natural ability. They got picked because they play well on instinct, but there's not something that can sustain and repeat at international level because the basis isn't there. And for people to say, for the futsal rules to do well, we need a national league and we need whatever, is partially correct. For the futsal rules to do well long time, we need to look at our coaching at the grassroots level and have a kid, a 12-year-old, knowing what his job is, whether he's defending or attacking at any time. So, yeah, it was an honor to be asked by Steve to help out, and that's what we worked on. Mm-hmm. And it worked.
We qualified. It didn't work. You guys qualified for the World Cup. It didn't get through the group stage, but you got a win over Mexico at the time. After the World Cup, you took the position of the head coach, and mm-hmm. Fernando, that was made to be a player, he had a knee injury. He became your assistant coach. What was the change at that time? When from the year before 2012, what did you try to change it to 2016?
It wasn't a question of changing anything. It was a question of, okay, we got a lot of players who already are at a certain level. Let's try and improve that. Let's put a little bit more emphasis on attack, okay? Because we didn't have to work so much with so many players on the defensive side of the game. It was just a question, like I said, it's not changing. It's just, let's go a step further now. Let's go a step further now. That is fine, but when you look at it, it means that it's very hard then to bring a lot of new players into the squad. Because if you keep bringing new players into the squad, guess what you got to do? You had to do what you did for the previous World Cup. Go back to basics with half of them. That's why selections are based, and we went through it for 2016. It's based on combinations. You have to pick combinations.
It's very hard to pick players that obviously are not in the setup for a little while when they have no experience. Obviously, you have to give them experience at some stage. But I think it's a short term goal, because obviously we don't train as much as we supposed to. Our preparation is very short. So you have to, as you're saying, we have to choose the right combinations and take the right players. Sometimes you leave a player that, you know, he might be good, but in our eyes, you know, some other player was better for the players that we're going to use around him. Obviously, we lost a couple of key players leading to the tournament. And it was hard. It's always going to be hard. And you're always going to have people, you know, complaining and saying he should be this, he should be there. And that's normal. Like, you got to make decisions. And we did. And I think we did it right, you know, in my eyes, and in our eyes, I think we did it right. We had a good conversation. I think
people have their opinions, and that's fine.
Exactly.
And but there are two types of opinions: informed opinions and non-informed opinions. I remember the AFC prior to the World Cup. On social media, which is a laugh, I got lambasted because we didn't take Shaveen. Shaveen had a broken foot. We couldn't take him. But people are criticizing the non-selection of a player, not knowing what the situation was. The World Cup in 2012, remember, Zevallos did his knee on the last training session warming down. Why aren't you taking Chris? What, to carry my bags? Got his knee in a brace. See, it's all right to have opinions, but you need to know what your opinion is about. But to answer your question, we didn't want to change things. We just wanted to try and improve a little bit more. The fact that we don't have regular camps makes it difficult to bring other new players in to expose them to what we're trying to do, whether I'm the coach or you're the coach or whoever's the coach, you know. And people say, oh, if you had an overseas coach, it'll be so much better. No, it wouldn't be any better because Pulpits would expect to have the players three nights a week and every second weekend.
I think it would be worse because they couldn't get much better results
with the amount of time.
He wouldn't know the players like we do.
Yeah.
Obviously, you got a better relationship with the players from where you're from, obviously New South Wales. Yeah. Me from Victoria. I know a couple of people from Queensland. So that's what we rely on.
Exactly.
And if you bring an overseas player or coach, he's not going to have that information. He's going to rely on people saying that those things and those information to him. But what's the difference? You know, like it's a bit tricky, I would say. It's a bit tricky.
And if we could, but like I said, that's part of the problem. But the other part of the problem is when players come in, talking to Venancio, the Spanish coach, he says, I don't pick the best 14. I pick the best 14 players to play the way I want him to play. I said, yeah, but the difference is your guys have all got the basics from by the age of 10, and then they get better. And I said, and I've got 500 people to choose from. I've got 5 dead set starters, and then the rest you can put a lot of names in a hat and take them out, and it wouldn't make much difference. He goes, I know where you're coming from, because when I coach Guatemala, I only have 5 good players. But that's the difference. That's his philosophy, and that's the philosophy of most coaches. You know, especially if you don't have enough time. Once again, you got to rely on combinations, and you know, and the players that you know. It'd be fantastic if whoever's the coach can have a camp every 3 months, and I'll say, okay, Fernando, I'm coming down to Melbourne. Put together your best 20 players, regardless of the ages. Okay, boys, this is what you need to learn. You want to make the Australian team? You need to be able to do this, 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 and this. Now you've seen it. Mm-hmm. Fernando's going to help you every second Saturday or every Saturday. You 3 hours every Saturday. Takes money. I know the commitment is there from people to do it, but the money isn't there to do it. So when in 3 months' time, when those kids come up, okay, Fernando, who are the best 10 out of the 20? Those 10. And I don't care what club they come from. I don't care how old they are. Let's send them to Sydney. The best 10 from South Australia, the best 10 from wherever. Rather than asking FFA to pay money to bring people into the squad, knowing that they're not ready and the amount of time they're going to spend in the squad is not going to change their performance. To any degree, they're going to say, okay, I can not take Basga, and I'm going to take Johnny Smith. We need to fix those things. The coaching at grassroots level, and then the ability to bring elite players together. That's the only way that the standard is going to, because we play way above our weight. We had a golden generation of futsal the last 6 to 10 years. That was our golden generation.
That's what I spoke to Bully about it. We had a great team. We had great players. I think we synced very well together.
Yeah.
And that was one of the best teams I personally ever played with.
Yeah.
And we found that after that generation, and we had good players, good kids, but they weren't the same thing. They were the same family as we were. Yeah.
Right.
And they didn't have the same heart. They didn't have the same desire as we did. Yeah. Nowadays, so much difference.
I mean, biggest rivalry in club futsal in Sydney, in a Western Duro. Hammer and tongs every game. Come together as part of the Australian team, best of mates. Come back from overseas, play the next week, hammer and tongs again. But once it was green and gold, it was green and gold. There was no Gerald D's or Inner West that or Enfield Rovers that or Muscle Vipers. You know, it was the Australian team. And that's the culture that Steve and I tried to build. And that's what it is. You're there, you're a fan.
So in 2016, in the World Cup, you had a good win against Mozambique, then a big loss to Brazil 11-1. But you scored the first goal. And for a big period of the game, it was a close game. Brazil ended up winning 11-1. And then the third game, you had a chance to qualify to the round of 16s for the first time in history. Had a good game against Ukraine, but lost 3-1. What would you say to that World Cup? What did you bring back from that World Cup?
To be perfectly honest, I think we lacked a little bit in the physical fitness thing, for starters. Because we were dominating Mozambique, and the last 3 or 4 minutes, we fell away badly. There were circumstances where players were injured, and we went the way of world best practices or monitoring people, giving me your number, giving me that number. I don't think we trained hard enough, to be honest. That's my opinion, okay? But I was dictated by FFA what we could and couldn't do. There was more, sometimes there were more players than you were there, Fernando, sitting on the sideline because they had a sore toe or the toenail was a little bit itchy and they should have been on the court running around. Be that as it may. That was our grand final. We indicated, we're good as a team, as a club, as a national team. We're good at targeting games. Our grand final wasn't Brazil or Ukraine. Our grand final was Mozambique. Because if we lost to Mozambique, the other two games didn't matter.
Correct.
And we got a result against Mozambique. Brazil is the target. Exactly. The Brazil game was the typical example of where we're at internationally in futsal. They score first, we score second. If you look at a goal, it was a counterattack. We ran away from Brazilians. Our problem with the good team is not the fitness itself. It's the quickness of the ball movement. We can't keep up eventually. And with 2 minutes to go or 3 minutes to go in the first half, we were 1-1. They went bang, bang, bang. Remember that Blake missed an open goal that could have put us 2-1? He hit the post on a counterattack. We could have gone into the second half 2-1. I don't think we would have won, but we go into the half 2-1. Instead, we went down 5-1 because they went bang, bang, bang. The problem you have as a coach, whether it's me, you, Miles Downey, Johnny Smith, Peter Brown, is you got 5 good players of the right standard. If you play them too long, they'll be dead in no time. So you got to sub them. And when you sub them, the ones that come on, in general terms, aren't as good. So your standard of play suffers anyway. And that's what, and this is not being, you know, disrespectful to the player because they are what they are. They're all trying their best. And then the second half against Brazil, for about 12, 13 minutes, no scores. But they scored 6 in the last 5. Because we couldn't lift their legs. We couldn't walk up to the halfway mark to kick off.
And when they keep up with the game, with the pace of that game for so long, we can't keep up. At one stage, your team's going to crumble. And that's roughly around 10 minutes into the second half. Yeah. Our team always starts to crumble. Players have been playing too many minutes to start to feel in their legs, making mistakes. So, you start subbing off those players, and the other players that haven't played too much have a big task in hand, and they can't adapt to the game and do well, and that's when you lose the game, and that happens in both World Cups. When you play teams in the same level as you, they crumble at the same time as you. So you can take the game to the last 5 minutes. And you can win or lose it in the game in the last 5 minutes. And that's very close. You play big nations, it's almost impossible. So as a coach, to put that in the head of a player, to say you got to believe in yourself and you got to understand that you got a chance to win the game. And if you do as we say, it's almost impossible for an Australian player to understand that.
Yeah.
And to understand that, to put that in their head, for them to believe. They have to believe. They play against Brazil. Yeah. And then you're already thinking, oh, we're going to lose. Some players already thinking.
Brazil was the current champion at that time as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And some players already are thinking about, are we going to exchange a shirt with, Falcao? Are we going to get, Bateria shirt? I'm going to take pictures here.
Yeah,
we're already losing the game right there.
Sure.
Exactly. Before the game starts, we lost the game right there. You know, so it's a lot of components that takes you to the game plan and execute properly and win the game. So it's too hard.
But Rob, we could see lots of improvement from... Yeah, go for it. Sorry.
We budgeted for a loss to Brazil. If we kept saying to them, we are going to win, we're going to win, and we get beaten 11-0, when we tell them the next 2 days later we can beat Ukraine, and we can, they're not going to believe you. Because you told me the same thing against the other. Ukraine were number 5 in the world. We dominated that game. We should have got a penalty with a minute to go that makes it 2-2, and we're in the second round. Be that as it may, we gave them 2 goals. Our bad play, our 2 big mistakes, gave them 2 goals. You always have to batch it for the referee making a mistake. But if we were 2-1 up instead of 2-1 down, not getting the penalty and them scoring when we're arguing wouldn't have mattered. So you can't just blame the referee. But we proved in that game, even though we lost 3-1, to a team ranked number 5 in the world of full-time professionals, that given the right circumstances, we can be competitive against the better teams.
So we saw 2012, a big improvement from 2012, 2016, nearly made it through to the round of 16s for the first time. And then after the World Cup, we had a big news of FFA cutting the funds. Australia didn't compete 3 times in the AFF, which is the Southeast Asia, 2016, 17, 18, and didn't compete in the 2018 AFC. How do you take that news, and how did that impact your progress?
Well, it's heartbreaking, not just for the coach, but for the sport in general. And given the fact of the amount of money that was being saved by cutting the funding of the futsal rules, my question at the time was, what the hell are you going to do with this money? You're not going to solve any big problems at FFA. It's not as if we're on $5 million budget. And all of a sudden, okay, now you only got $400,000. Nah. The money that was saved from not giving it to the futsal rules, I can't see what big problem, and they couldn't tell me what big problems they could fix. Because, like I said, we're not talking $5 million, are we? We're talking about massive problems in FFA, little amount of money from the futsal rules. And what really hurt is we never had a problem in terms of discipline. There was one discipline problem on an AFC tournament. It was dealt, bang, player back home. Don't worry about the details. We landed at the venue where we were playing. The next day, that player was the next plane back home. What happened was unacceptable, and it wasn't a question. He's going. That was one problem. Dealt like that. You hear rumors about other national teams. We've seen under 23 captain being banned or whatever. I don't know what happened, but it happened. Never a problem with our guys. Always competitive, always being great ambassadors. The trip to the school that we did in Colombia, Fernando, no one's asked us to.
Amazing experience,
The biggest discipline problem we had in Colombia was because they were scared of terrorists or whatever. We had 10 policemen with us. One guy walked across the road to the shop. And he forgot to tell the cop to come with him. That was the big problem. So that was disappointing.
Rob, did the FFA use these problems as an excuse?
No excuses. They told us that. What I'm saying is that is disappointing. There's no discipline problems with a competitive team that's the country proud and the futsal community proud. But they still not just cut the budget, slash it, gone, finished. Cut the careers of how many players, The reason was that money needs to be used somewhere else. Well, that was my initial question. My money, my budget, the budget that would have been set aside for the futsal rules, and I know how much it is, how big or how little it is, that wasn't going to solve a lot of other problems. You know what I mean? So that was disappointing. And the situation at the moment, nothing's changed. The funding will happen for a tournament like AFF that will lead to AFC, that will lead to a World Cup. So basically, you're looking at, when's the next World Cup? 2024? So it'll be the AFC at 2023.
A short window of time to prepare ourselves.
Absolutely.
For a AFF in 2022, for example, so only in 2023. because it's a yearly event. Yeah.
Exactly. And what we don't have this year, Fernando, is that core group of players, because they all got old together. And now this 2 years will be the chance to bring 19, 20, 21, 22, for them to become senior players. See, when we lost to Indonesia, they said, oh, you lost to Indonesia. They're all 22-year-olds. They've been together since the under-17s. They've been together for 5 years, 20 players. They're basically a club side. And one thing about the World Cup teams, in the preparation, the team that went to both World Cups, the full squad, never trained together, all of them, because someone saw leg or this, or got football. It never happened. And we still compete.
I don't think people understand the amount of effort that the other countries are making right now, especially Asian countries like Vietnam and Malaysia, Indonesia. They were those countries that we used to beat them in a hard game, but beat them easily. Somehow. And then throughout the years, we're starting to get worse, getting worse, getting worse. They were starting to catch up because they set up a program back in 2008, 2009, and 2010.
Yeah.
And they set up a program for 10 years. And then now they collecting everything they did back in the days. And that program is being very good. They bring up, obviously, they set up in schools. They bring international coaches to help out the setup.
Yeah.
They do everything properly, but in a long term. So obviously they have the money and the funds to do that.
Right.
And then that takes time. And now they're getting the benefit right now. See Vietnam and the way they play is amazing.
Exactly.
But
for them, they're not going to be great at football. So their money goes into futsal because their physique, the sharpness, the quickness, all that is suited more to futsal than it is to football. So they put in the resources more and more towards that.
So they see Australia losing to Malaysia or Indonesia or even Vietnam nowadays because they think, oh, we beat Vietnam in outdoor, or they're not a massive country, for football. No, they are amazingly good now in futsal, and they've been doing that for many years now. So It's hard to understand when you're outside and you're just watching the game and say, well, how can you not beat Vietnam or how can you not beat Malaysia? But
Indonesia,
that's a big story. So
they've got the infrastructure and we don't.
Yes.
Talking to Miguel when he was in Vietnam, I says, I've got all these players. I've got 20 others. And then I got another lot 5 years younger than them. He set up academies to teach him how to play the Spanish way or his way. And now whoever the national team coach of Vietnam is going to have this 20. In 5 years' time, there's another 20. In 10 years' time, there's another 20. And in 15 years' time, there's going to be another 20.
And they keep getting better.
Because they're being taught how to play.
And now we're probably going to be struggling to find, 10, 15 players to go to the national team because, one, that was not a setup. In that leading to the World Cup or leading to the big tournaments. COVID played a big part in that because most, especially Victorian players, we got more affected here. And third, what the clubs are going to do if there was not a national team, the players are going to leave and start playing more outdoor, focusing on outdoor rather than stay there and focus on futsal because they do have a pathway to go.
Tabi Siro,
very tricky.
He's not playing. Because he says, what's the point? I've got a young family, two young boys. My wife, before I could say to my wife, hey, I'm in the national team, I've got to play club. Now there's no national team. He says, what's the point of me playing club?
Yeah.
And he's not the only one. So it's going to be very, hopefully in a few years' time, people will sit back and reflect and realize how good the 20s, not because I was involved, but how good the 2016 and the 2012 teams were. Teams. I'm talking about teams, not just players, the whole
the whole thing.
The coaches, staff, the teams.
Yeah.
We went 1,000% better or what could have been expected from us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Rob, look at the future now. We know that definitely we've got even a question here asking if we've gone back 5-10 years. We have no doubt about that, But look at the future. So we're going to have the Nationals in January. It's going to be the first time they're going to have an open men and women after many years. So that's one exciting thing. I'll let you talk about that. The other exciting thing is there's talks about the F League coming back, a state F League and a national F League for each state.
Yeah.
How do you see these things coming? And how important would they be for futsal to get back on track in Australia?
It's good to have the men and the women back. Okay. I'm actually coaching the women's team, the New South Wales women's team. We had our trials this afternoon. It'll be a
nice
competitive team. Hopefully it'll be more than competitive. It'll be good. But once again, I watched the men's trialing, and for whatever reason, uncertainty of whether are they going to really happen. Am I going to pay money? See, it is sad, but it's a fact of life in our sport that our men and women's teams need to pay a good amount of money to go and represent the state. What the solution is, not 100% sure. But it's even harder for, say, for Victorian teams. They need to travel extra distance to go to, and then Western Australian teams again. But for us to be, we are a mini sport, we are a small sport, but we still should somehow do something so our elite, our men and our women, should not have to, number one, okay, they've got to take time of work, but go and stick their hands in the pocket to go and represent the state. So that's the problem, okay? But it is good that they're back. In regards to a national league, I am convinced. National league, the way it was in the past, in winter, no go. If you want to have the good players play. Mm-hmm. Because the better players in futsal, they play at a decent level in football. It's a fact of life. And no player that's getting paid $1,000 a week told the outdoor coach, I'm not coming to play top of the league game NPL 1 because I need to go down to Melbourne to play Melbourne United in futsal. To me, it needs to be a summer league. If you want the best players to play. The other side of the argument is, oh yeah, but then we'll have just futsal players. Yeah, we'll have no bloody good futsal players playing. So the choice is summer with a good futsal players playing, winter with very average futsal players playing. And that doesn't do the national league any good, the national league or the national team any good. If the product's no good, if I got to say to a sponsor, I've got 10 Johnny Smiths playing, but they're not good, or I've got 10 Greg Giovinalis or 10 Adam Coopers playing, you know, will you sponsor this team? Have a look at what they can do. Or I got 10 Rob Varellas playing that can't kick a ball. Would you sponsor that team? No. So my view is if we are going to run a national league, it will to be 100% successful in terms of the quality of the play, the input towards the national team, to be a benefit for the coach of the national team to have a look at the player, at the good players, it would need to be summer.
Mm-hmm. And would you have a preferred system of a national league that in your eyes would work?
It needs to comply with AFC regulations. We can play a national league on a long weekend. Everyone plays each other. Doesn't comply. It needs to be home and away. Everyone needs to play each other twice. Needs to be home and away. And games can say, Drew goes down to play Vipers on a Saturday. They cannot play whoever, Pascoe Vale on a Sunday. Games need
because
to have
already there.
A break in between. That's the only way it will comply. We got away with it in previous national leagues because we... Please, AFC, this is the only way you can do it. Fine. As soon as AFC said, okay, that's gone. You got to do it properly. We couldn't have a national league. I don't mind going down on a Friday night, play 2 games Saturday, 1 game Sunday. That's 3 games done. That's fine for me. But it doesn't comply with AFC. So whoever wins it cannot go to the AFC games as the club representative.
That's fine. That's fine for you because you weren't playing.
Yeah, I know. But you know what I mean? Yeah. And financially, you fly once to Melbourne and you play 3 games. Exactly. This way, you got to fly to Melbourne 3 times. 3 lots of accommodation. Oh, well, you come in Saturday morning, you go home Saturday night. But once, you know, but like I said, doesn't matter what my preference is or what Stephen Knight's preference is or what Fernando's or Andre's, doesn't make no difference. For the thing to be accepted by AFC, it has to comply with the AFC rules. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that makes things very tricky to run, doesn't it? Especially here. Absolutely. For the current situation.
It requires more money. Not just for the organizer, it requires more money for the clubs. And if you don't have television, if you go into a prospective sponsor, you're not asking for sponsorship. You're actually asking for a donation. Because what are they going to get for their money? You know, you come to Drill and you see 100 people at best watching the game. We go down to, is it Darama, whatever it is. That, you know, we're playing like we did once, and not the respect to St. Albans, whatever. There were 10 people watching. And it happened to be the mums and dads of some of the players. So what are you selling? You know, what are you selling the sponsor? You're not asking for sponsorship. You're asking for a donation, really. Please give me some money, because I can't give you anything back.
Yeah, but that's something that Futsal Laws always did well. They they did very good, you know, putting on social media and advertising everything. So you have more than 100 people watching the game on Wednesday night, in a small court and in in a suburb.
You need to put people to do the right jobs.
Exactly.
Football New South Wales, Football Victoria, you run the elite teams, your state teams, that sort of stuff. You go back long enough, Fernando, to remember Alistair Miller.
Yeah.
Vikings. Whatever his motives were, it's irrelevant. The guy was a genius at making money. You know?
Exactly,
so I remember meeting with the indoor soccer people back then, someone, and I said, what you do, don't fight Alistair Miller. Making your marketing manager. Get him to make money for you. At the moment, Alistair Miller is making 100% of a very small pie. Soccer Australia, whatever they were, are making 100% of a very small pie. Get Alistair Miller or Peter Parthamos or whoever, guy with marketing understanding, get that guy to grow the pie and he can have 25% of it. The 25% of a big pie is going to be more than 100% of a little pie. And everyone wins. Oh, no, we can't give Alistair that type of control. Well, he's not going to stop doing what he's doing. He's going to keep going against you. I'm not saying Peter is. I'm saying, you know, Alistair at the time, you know. But get someone who knows what they're doing to do their job for you. Pay him good money or give him an incentive to grow the pie so his percentage becomes bigger and bigger, and yours becomes bigger and bigger. Oh, no, we can't do that. What do we have now? We've got a dying futsal game.
Yeah, it's always going to be issues. It's always going to be problem, and especially financial problems. So it's a big problem.
Yeah,
so 2 weeks ago on the podcast, we had Eldon Ibrahim and Alex Novatsitsis. Alex is from Football West and Eldon is from Pro Futsal. And they are doing exactly what you said in WA. So in WA, they have handed over to Pro Futsal to run futsal for them in WA. And from their opinions, from their words, it's been very successful. Rob, just we're going to an hour and 10. This was meant to be an hour. It's very exciting. I don't want to finish. I want to keep on going. We could go for 2 hours, no problem. But we have to keep on starting to wrap it up. Rob, what's the future for you? What's left for you to achieve your career? Some plans that you can share with us?
Before COVID happened, not many people know this, I was just about to go to a Southeast Asian club. Okay? Signed for 2 years, was going to be the coach of the youth team, technical director, assistant to the men's coach, and the men's coach was stepping down, and I was going to take over. And all of a sudden, bang, COVID kicked it in the head. So that's something I still would like to do. I was approached by another country to coach their team, an AFF country to coach the team, and that was good, was going to happen. But that country had trouble. You might work out who it is, okay? So that's something I would like to do, okay? Go overseas and prove to myself that what we're doing here would also work somewhere else. And hopefully it validates what we've been doing here. Because, at the moment, short term, coaching in this, you know, because there's no Premier League. Our club and three other clubs put together what we call the Sydney Premier League, so the kids can have something to play until the end of December. So I'm coaching the women and the 17 girls there. I got the women's at the Nationals. And like I said, I'm open to help any coach anything. Someone asked me once, what's your biggest regret in the sport? You know, no winning this, no winning that. I always say that arguably my club side, the men's, have been the yardstick of the men's teams, New South Wales and around the country. Great rivalry with Vipers in F League, in the West and other clubs in Premier League. But you asked today, what do you do? How is it that you keep producing players that keep walking into the men's and women's teams, you know, and you seem to be regenerating the squad every 2 or 3 years and you keep... My biggest regret is no one in Sydney ever asked me that question. You're the second person in Victoria that's asked me that question. I said it at a presentation night because they asked me, what's your biggest regret? The fact that we have some sort of system and method that seems to work. If you're just judging by results, it seems to work. Well, doesn't seem to work. It works. But no one's ever said, how do you do it? What is it that you do? You know, so that is a source of regret. Once I've asked a coach of a Premier League team, says, this is what I want you to, because they said, what will it take for my guys to get into your team? Okay, they need to be able to do this, 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 and this. And their response was, don't tell me how to coach my team. I said, I'm not telling you how to coach your team. I'm telling you how to coach your players. You will benefit. Your team will benefit. But if you want your players, this is what I'm looking for in players. You might not agree, but if they can't do it, they're not in the Australian team. But that's my regret. The fact that there's a culture in futsal that I know something and I'm not telling anybody else. It goes back to 1988, 89, when I did my first coaching course in Victoria. And the coach who ran the course was a New South Wales guy. I asked a question. He said something. I said, what happened to you? He says, I'm not telling you. I said, well, is it because it's not part of the course? I said, no, because we're playing your Melbourne Buffaloes in 2 weeks' time. I don't want you to use it against me. I'm going, are you serious? See, there is that culture. I know something and I'm not telling you.
That I think that's a culture in Australia that we need to change, definitely. Yeah, and we need to learn from the Spanish coaches. The Spanish coaches need to teach us, or they teach us exactly, that we have to share knowledge with everyone.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I'm not dropping names, but I'm good friends with more with Miguel than Pulpis. But they help me. They give me material. They invited me to go and spend... One day when we get face-to-face, I'll tell you what they did with me that month. It'll be stupid of me not to share it here. Because I asked that question. Aren't you worried that we are going to improve? I said, yes, you are going to improve. But we still got a player than yours. But if you improve, we have to improve. Yeah. If Australia gets better, for us to keep beating Australia, we need to get better. And everyone needs to improve. And everyone benefits. So it'll be stupid for me. A couple of the girls today were asking me at the trials, so you're going to teach us how you girls play? I go, yeah. But what about when we play against you? I said, who cares? We need to get away from that mentality. I know something, I'm not telling anybody. That's a big regret of mine. People not having that mentality and not asking for help.
I think even COVID has brought us together more. I think hopefully we can change the culture in Australia. And that's one of the goals of this podcast, is to unite everyone in the country. Rob, to finish it off, we're going to play a game with you. It's called the Rapid Fire Questions, okay? Yep. You have 40 seconds to answer as many questions as you can. Right now, the top scorers are five people. So Jordan Guerrero, Peter Parthimos, Elder Abrahams, Alex Nofatsisis and Vinicius Leite. So all five people go 11 questions. But after that, no one is getting past 9, 10 questions. It's being really hard.
We'll be lucky.
So when you're ready, we're going to start.
Yeah, okay?
Don't think too much. Just get it going. All right? Yeah. So just give me 1 second to get it ready.
Can
here.
I say pass? All right. Can
well, I if say you pass, pass, you lose a point. You lose a point. So it's not worth it to pass. Just give an answer.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's start in 3 seconds. 3, 2, 1. Best futsal goalkeeper you have seen in Australia?
Thurlow.
Sorry, apologies. I'm going to restart because I got the wrong list here. I'm going to start again. That was not meant to be for you. So let's start one more time. Starting 3 seconds. 3, 2, 1, go. Greatest futsal player of all time.
In the world?
Yep.
Ricardinho.
Which system do you prefer, 3-1 or 4-0?
3-1.
Would you have throw-ins back in futsal?
Yes.
Do you prefer match reviews after matches or at the next training session?
Next training session.
Do you use magnets or markers on your coaching board?
Both.
Best futsal player you have ever coached against?
Greg. Against?
Yes.
Fernando de Moraes. In Australia.
I'm going to give you, time is off, but I'm going to give you the last one just because Fernando started laughing. Okay, I'm going to give you one extra question. What country plays the best style of futsal in your opinion?
Brazil.
All right, so that was 7 aces. Rob, it's not an easy game. You're an amazing coach, but unfortunately, this game, you go only 7. Rob,
my answers. That's the point.
Your shoe can double, Fernando.
Exactly.
I'm gonna just edit that part of the video, send it to you, Fernando.
No worries.
Rob, I want to thank you so much for being part of the show. It was an hour to any very enjoyable listening to you. We could stay here for 2 hours. People need to listen to you. People in Australia need to learn from your experience. And we're all very thankful to you.
My pleasure. If you wish, if you want to publish my email address on somewhere, whatever.
I was about to ask how can people get in contact with you, yeah?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, that'll be good.
Perfect. So I'll pull your email address. Fernandinho, thanks for being a co-host. You did an amazing job.
Thank you, man. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to be part of this interview here. We know great Robbie. Robbie's been a good man, a good part of my career. You know, I spent with Robbie and Steven, and you two taught me so much. And again, as you said, Andre said really well, people have to start listening to you and people like you and Steven and all those guys that have a lot of experience in the sport, the way they can learn out of you guys. So thanks, man. Thanks for being around, and maybe we can catch up soon.
Will do. My pleasure. Enjoyed it.
We're definitely going to have Steven very soon. But guys, before we go, next week we have another very special one. Ryan Shepard is going to be on the podcast. Talk about his refereeing career, his experience in the last few World Cups I think he's been to. So it's going to be another very exciting podcast. Thank you again, everyone, for listening. We are very committed to growing futsal in Australia, but you have to be too.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.